I wanted to just start by sharing with you a little story. I heard a preacher talking about conflict resolution, and it was on a Sunday morning, and he was talking to couples especially, saying, now look, whenever you guys are struggling and you're having arguments and, you know, problems in your relationship, I want you to remember the cross, because it was at the cross that Jesus gave his life, that he sacrificed himself to do what was best as opposed to how maybe it felt down deep inside. And he goes, I want you to remember that. And so after the service, I'm going to give every one of you a wooden, small wooden cross, and come by in the foyer and pick that up. And I want you to put it in the room where you and your spouse have the most arguments. And so people began to come by one, and he handed out those crosses. And then one lady stopped and said, Preacher, can I have five of those crosses? He said, five? What do you want to do with five? And she said, well, you see, we argue all over the house, so I'm going to put one in each of the rooms. Well, you know, we laugh at that, and it's kind of funny. But on the other hand, we know that also it's kind of sad, isn't it, to think about that there are couples and families out there that have to endure that kind of ill will and bitterness and just anxiety, and maybe have really not thought through about how to resolve conflict. Well, that's not the essence of our lesson here today. It really is, as you can see, about rekindling the devotion that we have for our marriage vows. But what we do want to talk about will hopefully help us when it comes to conflict resolution. When I think about, whoops, went too far there already. When I think about marriage and rekindling our devotion, I start by thinking about this nice little picturesque scene of a bride and groom starting their journey down the road. Just about every marriage ceremony I've ever been to ended with the couple driving off in a little car, right? Now, I have been to one, I was at one wedding where they rode off on horseback. Now, that was kind of different, right? Into the sunset. But most everybody starts in a car. But when they get going down the road and they encounter some of the hills and the valleys of marriage, or they begin to have a little engine problem, they forget about their vows. And they forget about how to do some work on that car. And they maybe don't have the tools that they need to make the engine repair. And they forget about some of the fundamental principles that we're going to talk about today. And so we want to spend just a little bit of time talking about the marriage vow and remembering what it is that we actually said, first of all, though there is nothing in the Bible about what has to be said at a marriage ceremony. And you will find from different cultures and from, you know, different ceremonies, to depending upon the preacher and the couple, they may say different things. But by and large, when we talk about the marriage vow, this is a sort of a generic one, and one that I hear a lot, and one that very similar to this that Carla and I had in our wedding ceremony. And you fill in the blank, but you're taking this man or this woman. And what does that mean? Well, we're taking them as they are. I really believe that. Not that we shouldn't expect one another to grow, but that we should remember that this person that we are seeking to unite our lives with has a unique personality, and there are things about that person that we should not expect to change. In other words, maybe they have a strange sort of laugh, maybe they have a snoring problem, or maybe they're just don't look the way that maybe you think they ought to look. Well, you're marrying that person as they are. Take them as they are. Now, I'm not talking about matters of sin. I'm not talking about us changing and growing spiritually and developing. But I'm saddened by the fact that sometimes people will make a vow and then they go through the ceremony making that vow, and then they set about to change their spouse and say, well, I really don't like you. I don't like the way you are. Well, that's not really fair. You know, if your spouse was a dog lover before you got married, and now you're married and you expect them to just not ever have anything to do with dogs, that's not right. That's not fair. And you say, well, if you'd love me, you'd get rid of those dogs. I don't think that's the way we should look at the marriage vow at all. We need to take that man or that woman as they are with regard to their personality and their traits. Again, not talking about our overlooking improvements that need to be made. And then we're taking them to be our lawfully wedded wife and husband, realizing that we are not only complying with the laws of the land, but we're complying with the laws of God and His law of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. But notice the emphasis upon our being wedded, that there is a union there that needs to take place. Does your house just, is your marriage just sort of one of those marriages that you've got two people living under the same roof, but they're not really united? Or maybe you know someone like that. The vow that we made, whether or not we understood it, I don't know. And it's sad to me that too many people come to stand before the preacher and they're making these vows and they've never even read them beforehand. They've never even thought about them. When I conduct a marriage ceremony, I give this to the couple to read. We talk about it. We study about it before they even get to the ceremony. Because I want them to know in this most serious, solemn promise that they're making what it is that they're saying. Because a lot of grooms, I know especially, usually like myself, are just looking around and kind of nervous. You know, I've never been before this many people and I'm wearing clothes that I don't usually wear. You know, and these shoes are killing my feet. And I'm thinking about all these other things. And so now the preacher's, and then he's right there and say, "Now do you, John, take this?" You know, so everybody can hear and it's kind of strange, isn't it? You're in this sort of unusual setting and you're getting ready to make the most important vow other than your commitment to Christ that you can make here upon this earth. So it behooves us to really think through what it is beforehand that we're saying. Now, maybe we didn't do that. And this is a time then for us to rekindle that particular vow that we've made, by understanding that this is a commitment to joining our lives together. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 19, in speaking about what God ordained from the very beginning, that a man should leave his mother and father and should cleave unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. So there is a leaving and a cleaving, a uniting. We are, Peter said in 1 Peter 3:7, to dwell with our wives according to knowledge, giving honor unto them as unto the weaker vessel, and that our prayer life not be hindered, because we are joint heirs of the grace of life, jointly participating and enjoying the blessings that God has for us. Now, I'm going to go through these and then we're going to really drive at what it is that can help us to rekindle this. If we've lost this, or maybe we're trying to help others that we minister to, that we counsel with, how to rekindle this as well. But we're to be lawfully wedded and we're making a vow to have and to hold. Isn't this really speaking to what God sees that we need as human beings, the psychological component, to understand that God wants us to be able to embrace, to hold? Yes, I believe there is an implication there of the sexual relationship, but more than that, God saw that it was not good for man to be alone. And so He made a helpmeet suitable for him. He was seeing to humanity's psychological needs, that we need someone to help validate our lives, to help us to have a sense of belongingness. It's a fundamental need that we have. Some of y'all may have studied sociology and perhaps learned about Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs as he saw us as human beings. What is it that we need? Well, we have to have food and shelter. That's a basic need. Safety. And then the third most important need that he saw that human beings desired to have was belongingness. Belongingness, right? I'm not so much concerned about shelter if I haven't eaten in so many days, right? But I start there. I gotta have some place to sleep. If those needs are met, then I move into the next one, and that's belongingness. We all have a need to feel like we belong to someone or something. And God created this union out of husband and wife to fulfill that basic need to have and to hold. But doing that in the good times and in the bad times, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. The truth is that life isn't always easy. These things come our way. Sometimes we're going to experience good days, and some days we're going to experience bad days. And that becomes very important for something we're going to talk about later on, to making sure that we're rekindling this vow that we're making. How do we make it through those tough times, the valleys? How do we continue to stay committed to our vow when our husband or our wife is sick. Now, to be a caregiver is a real challenge, isn't it? And I've seen that in a lot of families, whether it had to do with a marital situation or had to do with children taking care of their parents or vice versa. But it's not just the person who's sick, but it's the person that's providing for that person who is sick. That can take a toll on a relationship. And so there has to be something deeper there in terms of the marriage relationship other than just attraction or getting married out of convenience or for material things. There's got to be something that holds us together in these difficult times. A vow is a solemn, serious promise that we make before God and before others. So don't let your vows be empty or meaningless. Make certain that you are fulfilling this, that you are going to be true to your mate, united to them, serve them in the good times, in the bad times, from this day forward, from the day that you make the vow all the way until by death you're parted. Or God gives, of course, one other allowance for divorce, and that is for fornication, and mentioned in Matthew 19. But I want us to understand that this is a commitment that we're making. Think about that today. Think about that as you share that with others, this commitment to remain married, to not giving in so easily. Sometimes we're tempted to do that and to walk away from our commitments that we've made. And as we do that, this is the guiding principle that we hopefully remembered making, to live after God's ordinances, to live after what He has said about marriage, to what He said about our walk of faith here upon this earth. And if we will put that at the center and enthrone Him on our heart, then all these other things will become that much easier for us to do. So to live after God's ordinances or ordinance to love, honor, and cherish her or him. This is the operative word right here that we're going to focus on in just a moment. How is it that we can get to the point of where we can rekindle this vow, the love that we had on our marriage day, the excitement and the joy that was there, so that we truly honor and cherish that person? Those are words that really call for us to act, to behave in a way that may not always seem natural to us or easy, and yet it is life-changing when we do employ those particular traits and characteristics in our life and action types of things. And then, do you promise to keep yourself to her, to him, so long as you both shall live? To keep yourself, this purity in marriage, to understand that, I don't know if you've ever read the book Point Man, but it's a great book, men, if you've not read it, by Steve Farrar. And it's about how a man can lead his family. And one of the chapters in the book is called Burn the Ships. And he spoke about Cortez coming to the New World, and they were unloaded all the ships, and their objective was to start a new life. And one of the first things he did was burn the ships out in the harbor. Well, why do you think he did that? Anybody know? Why come all the way across the world, unload everything, and then burn those ships? Why would he do that? Huh? Can't go back, right? All of a sudden now, there is a huge incentive for the men to say, we have no other choice. We have no way. There's no turning back. We've got to make this work, or we're going to die on this island. Now, that's his point in the book. When you get married, you burn the ships. There's no, well, I wish I'd have had this, or I wish I'd have done that, or, and sometimes men and women get to comparing their husband or their spouse to everybody else. And let me tell you, when you start down that road, you're asking for trouble, and it's just going to end in misery. Because you know what the old saying goes? The grass is always greener on the other side of the fence, isn't it? It always looks better over there. Carla and I like to share with couples this little thing that we read somewhere one time about how that we're tempted to judge our own brokenness in light of someone else's highlight reel. You ever get on Facebook or social media and you start seeing, you know, all these pictures of a couple that are so happy in these families, you know, and you start going, oh, wow, man, they just got everything going for them. And I mean, it's just, and you start looking at their portraits. You know, you didn't see that for hours they spent time getting all cleaned up and ready for that picture. And then the photographer got just the lighting on the right one the right way. You know, they don't even look that good in reality, right? But we judge ourselves, we tend to, on everybody else's highlight reel. And we don't understand that those families, those couples have struggles. And their husband maybe isn't always as good to her as we like to think maybe they are. Well, maybe they're acting better than our husband. I'm not saying that. Or maybe they're acting better than our wife. My point is that there is a temptation on the part of many to judge their relationship on the basis of what everybody else is doing. And it may not always be that good, number one. Number two, you can't go there because you've made a decision to work this out. And the devil wants nothing more than to sort of drive a wedge between you, to get the proverbial nose of the camel under the tent, to get you to doubting, questioning, and, you know, work at you from that angle. But God says, you're making a promise to keep yourself to him or her so long as you both shall live. Now, there are a lot of marriage vows that have been recited at various ceremonies. I thought, we as a culture maybe need to think about how to improve upon some of these. And I have. I've asked couples now to sort of work on their own vows. Now, I make sure, I'd like to say, look, I think you really ought to say this and make this commitment to each other. But I was impressed even with some elements of this one in the Hindu culture. They take these steps, and each step they take, they recite something. And notice some of what they say. We will provide for and support each other. Now, that's a pretty important element to a marriage vow, that we will develop mental, physical, and spiritual strength. I think sometimes we're not taking care of ourselves in these various aspects. This one, of course, is the most important part. The Christian must be spiritually strong, but good mental health and physical health. And all of those, and I have a background in counseling, and from a biblical perspective, God addresses all of that. That we need to take care of body, soul, and mind, because they are interrelated in terms of how we feel and how we look at the world around us. So the third step, they say, we'll share the worldly possessions. Fourth step, we will acquire knowledge, happiness, and peace. That's the goal, to serve God. And as a byproduct, then we're going to have these things like happiness and peace. The fifth step, we'll raise strong and virtuous children. The sixth step, we will enjoy the fruits of all seasons. And the seventh step, we will always remain friends and cherish each other. This is, I believe, sort of a forgotten component in some marriages. And I'm calling on of us today as husband and wives to develop that friendship, as we'll see in a moment, this phileo love. So I think that there are some elements to that marriage vow that is taken there that we could say are not Hindu, they're Christian principles. Here is one, a Jewish marriage vow that I found kind of interesting. Behold, you are consecrated to me with this ring according to the law of Moses and Israel. Well, we say something similar, right? When with this ring I thee wed, and with all my love I endow to thee, and something similar to that, or I promise myself. Well, you are consecrated to me. You're set apart. I'm showing by this ring that I've set you apart as what? As someone that I'm going to highly prize and value. And then not only that, look at this. I betroth you to myself forever. I betroth you to myself in righteousness and in justice, in love, and in mercy. Now, last night I spoke about mercy in the auditorium. Do you think that applies in the marriage relationship? Yes. Show compassion and love and mercy. Now, can I just stop for a second? Because while I'm thinking about this, talking about rekindling our marriage vow, to me, one of the most significant parts of our having a successful marriage is to realize that our husband and our wife is never truly worthy of God's grace and mercy. None of us are. Right? None of us are so good and so wonderful that God says, okay, I owe you salvation. Now, if we understand that from a perspective and even looking in our own lives, that God can't look at us and we wouldn't expect Him to say, look, you owe this to me. But that He did it out of what we needed, not because of what we deserved and who we are, but because of what we needed, He put a plan in place to show His love for us. Can we not therefore then exhibit that and should and must in our own marriages? Because I have worked with a lot of couples, Carl and I have, who have come and sat before us and said, look, you just don't know what kind of wife I have. Or you just don't know what kind of husband I have and the way he really acts. Well, I'm not saying that he's not doing some evil things. I'm not saying that he's a good person and a perfect person. But if we wait till he's perfect or that she's perfect before we start showing and doing what we're supposed to do, we'll never do it. The very essence of mercy and grace is expending love upon totally unworthy objects. And once we get that into our mind and we understand that biblical concept, it transforms marriages. Of our saying, I am going to show mercy. Do you think that guy on the road, the Good Samaritan that we spoke about last night, looked at that guy that had fallen among thieves and said, oh, well, there's a guy that's perfect. No, he gave him what he needed. And if we can do that, then it's easier to love like we should love, to have mercy, because mercy grants forgiveness and an opportunity for totally. God is the one that judges. He'll work it out in the end. Our job is to love and forgive. God is the one that's going to bring judgment. When did God start loving you? When did He start loving you? Before you were born. And not only before you were born, but He says, talking about humanity, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. While we were yet sinners. That's what, in many ways, lures us to the cross, isn't it? I mean, we don't come to want to serve God simply because He's up there saying, listen, you are a sorry, no good for nothing person, and I don't like you, but I'm going to judge you one day, so you better get it right. You know, does that draw us to God? What did Paul say brought him to Christ? The love of Christ compels us. What did John say in 1 John about why we love Him? Because He first loved us. When I was a kid, I didn't understand that. I thought, well, that seems kind of, you know, we're only going to love you, God, because you loved us first. That's not what He's saying. It's because God loved us so much that we want to love Him. See, that's really the essence of rekindling your marriage vow, is by understanding that it begins with me. It begins by my not having all these huge expectations that, because really, you know, some of us have expectations that no one could meet. And we've got to quit having that and just focus on what I can do and what I can change within myself and let God do the work. Let God do the work. Now, I'm not saying that if someone is abusing you that you have to stand there and take that. That's a sin. That is absolutely a sin for someone to strike another person. And it is illegal, right? It is, what's the word I'm looking for? Well, it's abuse. It's a assault, thank you. From a legal perspective, it's assault. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about the day-to-day kinds of things that we're struggling with in a marriage when someone isn't. We made a vow. Now we're going to rekindle our devotion to God to fulfill and do what God Himself did for us and see what can happen as a result of that. I betroth you to myself in faithfulness, and you shall know God. And of course, they would not pronounce God's name, and so you'll see that hyphenated a lot of times like that. But in faithfulness, and I like this, and you shall know God. Wouldn't that be great if every couple came before the so-called altar of marriage and said, what I want for you, and what I promise I'm going to help you to do, is to know God. To know God. If I could just live in such a way that my wife would see God in me, do you think she would want to love me more? Absolutely. So, vows that we make. But the truth is, as we get going down the road of marriage, we start to run on empty, don't we? Man, that all those things we just looked at a while ago, all those vows, that's a tall order, isn't it? It's a tall order. Especially when we're dealing with imperfect beings. And so we start running on empty. And, you know, it's not any fun running out of gas on a lonely road. You're headed for somewhere very important you thought was going to be great, and now all of a sudden you're stranded. And the tank is empty. What we need to do is put something in the tank so that we can get to this point in our life where we are 50, 60 years in our marriage, or as one couple recently in our community celebrated their 75th wedding anniversary. Isn't that marvelous? 75 years. I kidded with them. I said, did y'all get married when you were five or what? You know, 75 years. Well, the way that we're going to get to that point where we're rekindling, because we always have to kind of keep realigning, is we've got to put something in the tank. Now, that reminds me of something I want to share with you. Are there pilots? Anybody have their pilot's license in here? Everybody flown a plane? Okay, good. So now I can talk and you won't really know that I don't know what I'm talking about. But all right, I flew with a preacher one time who had his pilot's license, and against my better judgment, I went up there with him. But really, he was kind of a person that, he had a, some would say he had attention deficit disorder, and he was constantly moving all the way. But when he got in a plane, boy, it was in his element, because he had so many things to occupy his mind all the time. I'd never seen anything like it. He's always talk, got up there just flying, just as nice, you know. But he was talking to me about this one day, and I'd read it about other pilots, that, you know, you get ready in there and you set your coordinates for where you want to go. But what you've got to do is constantly check those coordinates and make sure that you're on that line that you've created for yourself and your goal. Because if you don't, a little bit of a crosswind right here, as you get started in your journey, will blow you off just a little. And if you don't make the correction and get back online, what happens the further you go, the further off your target you get, right? Just by one little degree right here, the further you go, you compound that error so that you get further and further away from the goal. You've got to realign, recorrect. And that's what marriage demands, because life is fluid, it's changing, we change, life changes us sometimes. And we have to constantly communicate, realign, and talk about these vows and see how we're doing, do a checkup, you know, and not like the old guy that, you know, had to, his wife ask him and says, do you love me? He said, yeah, I told you 20 years ago when I married you I loved you, and you ought to know that, you know. No, we need to be telling our wives all the time that we love them. We need to see what they need and what we need out of each other and communicate about these things. So keep focusing. Make sure we are putting the fuel in the tank. And the fuel in the tank that we've got to have, and I don't want to oversimplify it, but as you begin to analyze what we're going to talk about, the fuel in the tank is love. That is the absolute most important ingredient. We'll talk about what it means. But Paul said this. How important is it? When he wrote to the church at Thessalonica, a young church, he says, I want to come and perfect that which is lacking in your faith. And that I'm praying night and day that you may abound in love one toward another. Abound in it. Some of us just dabble in love. Paul says, abound in it. And then if you were to look at Philippians 1, 9 through 11, when Paul said to the church of Philippi, I'm praying for you what? Listen, look at it. That your love may abound and that it would do so on the basis of our having a knowledge and discernment about love. So that, now here's what it's leading to. We might learn to approve the things that are excellent. We might be sincere without offense to the day of Christ. That we might be filled with the fruits of righteousness, which are by Jesus Christ, the glory and praise of God. We want a marriage that praises God, that brings glory to God. We'd like to have a marriage that's full of fruits of righteousness, that is genuine, that's without offense, that puts the approval on things that are high and good and excellent. How's it going to happen? When we are growing in our love, our knowledge, and discernment about that. Now, that's just two passages in the Bible that speak about the necessity of love. So, if we're to abound in it, what is it? Well, you know, it's that feeling, right? As psychology today would say, is a something you can't command. This is what the world says love is, and this is what a lot of people think it is. It says, however much we may want to, we cannot command a man or disappear love any more than we can command the moon and the stars and the wind and the rain to come and go according to our whims. Listen, the world says love strikes like lightning. It's unpredictable. It's irrefutable. It strikes. You know, it's like a feeling, right? Well, by the way, I was shared this one time. I was preaching, and God just heard the kind of the end of it here. And I got to, he said, amen. I was like, no, this doesn't deserve an amen. This is not the right definition. Now, it is true that love involves a lot of things. But let's end our session here today with three important elements of what love is. The fuel in the tank to rekindle our devotion for our marriage vow. The first thing is that we have to remember that love is an action. It's not simply a feeling, but based on 1 Corinthians chapter 3, it involves our being kind. It involves, yes, an attitude and a state of mind that produces actions. Because if we're arrogant, if we're prideful, if we're taking account of wrong, then it's going to be manifested in the way we treat our spouse. We're going to withhold good. We're going to withhold mercy. But love is something that you do, not just something that you say. Right? Love is an action. Then secondly, I want you to know this. Now, Josh, when am I supposed to? I haven't been paying attention. How much more time do I have?
You're going to have a bell. I don't have the actual.
Okay.
I stepped out.
Okay. So the second thing is that love. So if I get the first bell, better hang on to your head. I'll probably zip right down to the end. But the second thing is, the world says love is a feeling, but God says love is a decision. You know, as wonderful and as great and as beautiful as my wife is, I got confession time here, okay? Sometimes I don't feel like cherishing and nourishing her like I know I'm supposed to according to Ephesians 5. Sometimes I just, you know, if we have a disagreement, I just, you know, rather not listen. I want to do what I want to do. Now, that's how I feel sometimes. But true love says, no, it's not a feeling, it's a decision that we make. And you know how I know that? Because if you were to look at some of these passages in the Greek language, or even you can see it even in the English language, but the Greek makes it especially clear. It uses the imperative mood. It's the language of commandment. It's the language of saying, this is what I'm calling you to do. You have to do it. Love your enemies. See, that's not natural. I don't feel like loving my enemies. But Jesus said, love them. So that says, okay, that's a decision. And when someone's doing evil things to me like they did to Jesus on the cross, do you think he felt physiologically a warm sort of deep sensation about, oh, come on, hit me some more? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. God, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Love is not simply a feeling. It is a decision. It's a command. We can command actions, behaviors, and attitudes. I know because my dad told me when I was little to wipe, you know, that little smirk off my face. Or he'd say, now listen, you know, you don't need to be upset about what you've done wrong. You're getting your privileges taken away. Now listen, you need to shape up. I began to realize, you know, I'd have a sour attitude because I didn't like something. Well, I learned that I could, I need to change my attitude about this. I'm thinking about this all wrong. Love is a decision that I make that says I'm going to do what's right, even though I may feel like doing something differently. Now, in the Greek language, there are four types of love to sort of describe an array of things that we sometimes talk about when it comes to love. And one of them is the Greek word eros for the word attraction. The word erotic comes from that word, and it usually has reference to sexual attraction. Now, marriages can't be based on that. It's an important element. God made us in such a way to be attracted to one another. But if our relationship is based purely upon the physical, then we're headed for disaster. Now, this word is not found in the Bible. But we understand as human beings that it's an important element, but that's not the love that God calls us to have in a marriage. The word storge was a word used in the Greek culture to refer to this family connection that exists, a bond that exists between family members, a familial love. The Bible doesn't mention this, but only once in the negative sense when it says that there were some who did not have this natural affection as some translations translate it. But then there are two words that are in the Bible that are sometimes used interchangeably, phileo and agape. But many times I think that you can separate them out to show that there's a subtle difference or a unique difference between the two. The first one is a love that seems to be very natural. It's what we sometimes call phileo, the what love? The brotherly love. The city, Philadelphia is a city of brotherly love. It speaks about the love that comes from common experiences, like having a work day at the church building and, you know, maybe two people didn't really know each other and they're in there, you know, cleaning a room or painting a room or something and they're working in there and then all of a sudden someone gets paint splattered all over them and it looks like they have a disease and we kind of make, fun of each other and about it or whatever. Didn't know each other very much before, but the next day on Sunday, we're going, hey, man, you remember yesterday and they're painting, you got that paint all over, yeah. And they're talking about it. All of a sudden, there's a connection. There's a bond there, right? Because of something they did together. Love demands that we cultivate our connection by doing things together. So if we want to fulfill our marriage vow, we've got to have love in the tank. And true love demands that we cultivate it, that we then understand it's easy to love those who love us and that it's reciprocated, but it has to be nurtured. And we think about doing things that nurture that brotherliness, that friendship. But then there is agape love that is the highest form of love that we know is a decision that is unconditional. We don't withhold love. We don't love whenever this person says, well, all right, you know what? Okay, whenever you do the five things that I'm asking you to do, okay, then I'll love you. Because if that's the case, then none of us would love each other because we'd always have these conditions out there that would never be met. God loved us when we were still in our sin. That doesn't mean he approved of the sin, but it just means that he's constantly wooing us to come back to him. When was God, and I mentioned this last night from 2 Corinthians chapter 5, what was he doing in Christ when Jesus died upon the cross? Reconciling the world unto himself. God, who had been offended, was seeking to get the world to come back to him by loving them. And so, if we have made a commitment to love our spouse, as we said in our marriage vow, we need to make sure that we are practicing agape love. Vine's Expository Dictionary says this, what he says, it often goes against the natural inclinations. The natural inclinations. This love does. You see, it's the love that says, Love your enemies. Now, I've talked with spouses before who were really at odds with one another and sitting across me from me in my office and across my desk, and I'd say, Bill, is Beverly your enemy? No. Well, Bill, if Jesus says love your enemies and to do good to them that despitefully use you and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you falsely, if you're to love your enemy, how much more should you love your wife? Love your husband? Again, are they worthy of it? Well, God says He loves the world. Have they risen to an occasion of being worthy of our great love? We may not think so, but that's not the point. The point is, we love the unlovable like God loves us. Which leads us to the last point of what true love is and understanding as we abound in it, as we seek to be knowledgeable of what love is. God is love. God is love. God so loved the world that He did what? Gave. God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. God so loved the world that He gave. You ever broken that down in John 3:16? God so loved the world. That's everybody. That He gave. Love is giving. And to be like God, we have to give. And sometimes that means sacrificing. Sometimes that means putting our own will aside. It means always doing what is best and what is right. It is reflected, of course, in the story of the cross. Sacrifice. How do I rekindle my spirit to fulfill my wedding vows? I look right here. I look right here. Because it's not easy doing what's right. But praise be to God, our Savior did, that God did. And thus, we want to love God because He loved us. See if that will transform your marriage. See what that will do. Don't let your bitterness and your anger and your frustration be that which is seen, because that's not attractive, I can tell you. Believe me, I've tried to woo people, or to my wife, or to try to get people to do what I want by sulking. Yeah. It's not attractive, I can tell you, right? I saw myself in the mirror one time, kind of trying to look mean and mad, and it was scary. It's not attractive. Let me tell you what is attractive. Is giving and kindness and grace. Oh, wow. That's attractive. That is attractive. Now, I mentioned this last time, Ephesians 3:14-21. Paul's powerful prayer focuses on the brethren knowing the love of Christ. The height, the breadth, and the width, and the depth of it. If you weren't here last night, you may not have heard this, but does anybody remember what I asked, what I made a comparison to? What is every woman going to usually have on her, if she's married, on her ring? A lot of them, not everybody. A diamond. Does anybody remember the illustration? I put you on the spot here. What was it I said, just to give you a little chance to talk here? What about that diamond? All right. And when you do, then you're going to be able to know how valuable it is. Right? We can see it from afar. It looks okay. It looks nice, but it might be something you got out of a gun machine. I don't know. But until I look at it closely, all the facets of it, then I can see all its value. The same thing. The more we know about God, looking carefully at every page of the Bible about who He is, the more we're going to know about love, and that will be transformative. What happened when Moses went up on the mountain? He said, Exodus chapter 33, I want to see your glory. Chapter 34, God, show me your glory. So God says, all right, I'll take you to the mountain. I'll show you my glory. What happened when he saw his glory? Huh? His face did shine, and the people said what? Too bright. Put a veil over your face. So in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, Paul speaks about this. And he talks about the Jews having a veil over their face and they're not seeing the glory of God. But then he makes a reference to, at the end of that chapter, that says, in essence, that when we look into the face of God, it's transformative. That it causes us to reflect Him, His glory. And as we continue to look into the face of God, as it were, as we see Jesus, because He is the living exegete of God, He came to declare God unto us, and we constantly look into His face and see how He is, and God, let me be like You, then we'll reflect that glory in our own marriage, because we've been in the presence of God. I think that's a part of what Paul was saying about why I want you to know every element and aspect of the love of God. Because then it leads you to the fullness of God. Are we okay? Okay. The fullness of God. I like this, talking about rekindling our devotion. If every one of us sought to do that, to be like God, the truth is that then as husband and wife, if we'll put God first in our relationship, then the closer we get to God, the closer we're going to be to each other. That's the key. God is love, being like God, loving God with all of our heart, soul, and mind. We do that, wow. Then we're going to have a source of strength there that will be unimaginable, that will be truly glorious and wonderful, that looks past the imperfections, that's not focused on outward appearance, that's focused upon something intrinsically good that sustains us. Now, as we think about love in the tank, here is a love dare I want to make. Here is a challenge I want to give you, and it's based on the Love Dare book. Some of you might have seen the movie Fireproof, and if you haven't seen it, you ought to get it and watch it, because it's really good. I think that it has encouraged and helped a lot of marriages. But in there, they utilize a book that this father of this son who's struggling in his marriage says, look, before you throw in the towel, you know, before you give up, I want you to take this love dare. Just promise me for 40 days you'll follow this and see if it changes your marriage. So, you know, he didn't want to do it at first, right? And he struggles with it, and, you know, day one, day two. And they're all little short things, but you ought to go out and buy that book. Now, there's some things in it I don't agree with, a few things. I've got my own little version of it that Carl and I worked on to kind of create just as far as some things in it. But I think it will rekindle the vows that you made. You say, well, my husband or my wife's not interested in doing it. That's the point. You don't do it because they do or don't do it. You do it. And if you do it, see what will happen. See how it will change your relationship. Don't tell them you're out going out and get the book. Just get the book. And don't, you know, we're real good at this, right? Can say, well, you know, y'all today, we throw that in front of them. You know, we put out a book out there and we want them to see it, right? We're really good about that. Happen to leave a chapter open. And I was just happening to read this. And, you know, we kind of subtle and we manipulate sometimes. But just live it out in your life. Just live it out in your life. Then you get to the point where you can say and talk in a way that's good, that you can resolve these things. And here's another book I want to recommend to you, because it really does address this issue of love in a way that has been helpful to a lot of couples. I wish I had, you know, well, maybe I should say $50, not $1, because it's not that many, but $50 for every person that told me that they wish they had read this book early on in their marriage. I mean, grown women that said, if I had read that, and what I found out from that book, it would have changed our marriage and we wouldn't have been, you know, had all these problems all these years. And what he didn't said, came to understand is that, you know, we tend to express love in different ways. And that some speak a love language of words of affirmation. Maybe that's how they grew up in their family, that love was communicated, not so much shown physically. You know, that's the way my dad was. He grew up in a family. They didn't really say it. They didn't really touch, you know, hug that much, even though I'm a huggy-feely kind of person. But I remember going off to college and, you know, in the church there, they said, hey, I love you, brother, and all that. So I came back, and I'll never forget when I came back from college, and I said, Dad, I love you. And he goes, same to you, son. You know, well, he grew up in a different culture, different time. They just didn't say it. I knew he loved me, though. I mean, it wasn't like I had some sort of chip on my shoulder, because he did it by quality time, acts of service, and receiving gifts. And then, you know, the first time, you know, we hugged, he kind of did that, you know, whatever. It's so funny. But my boys, man, we embrace. And there's a real focus on this. But read that book. Understand what is your spouse's love language and learn to speak it. And don't expect them to speak your language. Well, it's been good being with you. Our time is up. Let's rekindle the devotion we have. And in the words of this psalm, let us love one another. Let us love one another. Thank you so much for being here.